Afternoon on a hot, sunny day in Harare. It's October. The October heat is here. I think this is the times when I really wish for the rains, just to cool off. But it's green, so that's the consolation prize that we get. But you know, I get really tired when it's sunny and it's hot. I don't know how you guys are surviving in October, in this October sun.
I love the hot, sunny weather.
Yep. And you're not
bright sunny days.
You're not at a beach somewhere.
No,
I bright sunny days are my favorite by far.
Really,
but it's scorching. It's
not. Yeah, bright sunny. Look, you know, if you're indoors, hopefully you're working somewhere with electricity and air conditioning.
That's a lot of work.
That's a big ask.
It's a big ask for love. Being in the garden and now it's just impossible. Even the shade, you can't really enjoy it as much.
I prefer the warm weather. I struggle with the when it's very cold.
Yeah, we're kindred spirits there, my brother.
Yeah. So.
And when it's scorching like this.
Yeah. Well, I think all that you probably can do is to look for some comfortable shade. So when I came through, obviously some of us, we are fairly flexible in our working environment. So since morning I've been working from the shade. I wasn't in the office, just under a tree doing my work, as long as I've got Wi-Fi connection
and my
gadgets are working, then I'm good to go.
I don't know about you guys, but to me, I'm just looking forward to the rain. It looks like it's going to rain, but I just hope it does rain.
Last week, there was some bit of that.
We had lots of rain in some
areas. So it looked quite promising, but it didn't rain as much as I would have wanted. But yeah, we are in that space already, so probably it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I hear we might actually have another drought if we're unlucky.
Well, we'll get into the details and we'll read through the news as far as the agriculture season is concerned. It's a big ask and it's something that we have to keep our tab on because it more or less defines what next year is going to look like. So, you know, the more information that we have, the better. And that's something that we will discuss later on. In fact, we've got a jam-packed session for you guys. We'll talk about agriculture. We'll talk about how it will impact the GDP. We'll talk about the energy crisis, which we still have. We'll talk about Steve Hank's inflation rate, which is 1,300%, the highest in the world. What does that mean? We'll talk about Zimra under strain as far as revenue collections is concerned. We'll talk about the liquidity crunch. The market is short of ZIG. What's actually happening? What does that actually mean? But before we go any further, maybe let's start. Well, we'll discuss the legacy debt because I think that's a big issue that we need to discuss and the implications because I think a lot of people have forgotten about the legacy debt and I think it's going to have a big impact on our economy, especially in the next 2 years or so. But before we go any further, maybe let's actually discuss what we're having. Shumba, would you like to tell us exactly what you're having?
Yeah, I've discovered this. I'm not sure whether we've had this on the show before, this version of Lafarg.
Are you earnestly asking us?
Well, unfortunately, you know, the two of you wouldn't...
Because they're trying to...
The two of you wouldn't have any recollection of what I haven't had on the show. But I've certainly had Lafarg on the show before. This is a new incarnation of Lafarg. They call it the PX cask version, and that's because it's matured in three different casks, and the last cask is a Spanish Pedro Hermes sherry cask that they mature it in, hence the name of the PX cask. It's from the island of Islay in Scotland, so it's very peaty. And you know it's matured in bourbon and sherry and quarter casks, so it should have some sweetness as well. So good times on this end of the table. You guys are becoming more and more creative in terms of what you've been drinking lately, which I quite like because you know the tea trottling corner used to be the boring corner, but these days you're mixing it up and doing interesting things. And making a mess while you're at it. Yeah.
As well. For the so, cause.
That is what he just wanted to say.
So what are you guys doing today? What
I was trying to pay attention to you when you were just going on and on about the ingredients, and if some alien was to fall from Mars and you know, just listen to you, they'll think that there's some special, you know, discovery or invention on Earth, and you know, they would wait and wait to hear about what exactly happened, only to realize that it's alcohol.
It's just alcohol.
Yeah, you know, it's not different from anything that can get you high, right? Masese or yeah.
That is a classic Philistines take. I think anybody who imbibes will tell you that different types of alcohol are different. So wine is different from beer, is different from ciders, and whiskey is different from vodka, and different from rum. And within each category, right? Not all beers are the same. Not all whiskeys are the same. Not all vodkas are the same. There's you know, and people will tell you that there's some really amazing versions of beer, and there's some that aren't that interesting. So, I mean, it's just like anything, really. If you think about your soft drinks, right? There's some that you really like, and then there's some that you're not so fond of.
I think the point that Ranga is trying to make is that we don't go overboard with, you know, waxing lyrically
about
the type of soft drink that we're having. We're quite aware that we're having sugar.
Yeah. or maybe you guys are just Philistines. You're just neither curious nor knowledgeable about what you drink.
We're certainly esthetes, but we're aesthetic about certain things, and we know when there's no aestheticism on a particular thing, then we just let it go. There's nothing to enjoy.
Okay, well, keep telling yourselves that. I think you guys are just Philistines.
Yeah, well, you know.
Anyway, cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. We are having a Malawi shanty. You know, in the common, one friend said I put in a little too much of the bitters, but I quite like the color.
Yeah, I must say.
Well, you have to make your drinks interesting somehow, right? Coloring, you know.
I must say that
the
Malawi shanty prepared by Mukanya here, I actually rate it highly. Having tested some horrible stuff at one of the leading hotels.
I don't think it was horrible. I think you just have a sensitive constitution, and somehow Mukanya's concoctions don't seem to upset your system.
Well, I must say, no one has ever found my concoctions disagreeable. I think a lot of people have nice things to say about, you know, my concoctions, of which there are many, and they have nice things to say.
Yeah, even
which goes to show that
kudos to you.
Yeah, yeah, even for some of us who've got fragile tummies, we can just go through this one without any issues.
Goes to show there are many ways in which you can make the bar exciting without alcohol.
Exactly. It reminds me of you know, like this comment. I love reading the comments every time we have a show. Mm. And then there was one viewer was saying, fantastic job you guys are doing, but do you have to advertise all the beer? And, you know, the people that are struggling with alcoholism, you know, you have to think about them. No, they're not going to think about them. They have to think for themselves. You know, I think people are adults. They have to be responsible. And surely, I mean, when you look at the bar, the two of us are drinking Malawi shanty. So if this particular brother or sister, you know, just
cannot
decides...
learn something.
Yeah, they're not learning anything from what you're drinking here, and decides that they are inspired by Shumba, how is that our problem?
In fact, it speaks volumes to them.
Exactly. I think we have tried to keep a balance. I think a big takeaway from the Friday drink show and the way even the bar is set up is, you know what? So we're trying to demystify the notion that people only go to the bar to get high. You can actually also be in the bar and have a Malawi shanty.
Interact with interesting people.
Interact with interesting
people. Tend to be drinkers.
So if you are looking for inspiration or you are struggling with alcoholism, look at us, me and Mkanya. But if you are inspired by Shumba there, then be his guest.
No, he was triggered by Shumba.
How dare he drink alcohol?
So he has got more problems.
You need to share that comment. You need to share that comment because that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh, you were triggered by Shumba.
Exactly. No, you have to think about people who are struggling with alcoholism. Like, no, those people must look at Mkanya and myself. If they decide to look at Shumba.
That's hilarious. Cheers to that.
Cheers.
Good, eh?
Yeah, very good. Just very good.
Just what I needed on a hot Friday afternoon.
Fantastic.
Okay, so gentlemen, let's get into the weeds. The first thing that we need to talk about is the $2.9 billion in as far as legacy debt or blocked funds is concerned. For those of you who are not Zimbabwean, because I know we've got a large constituent of people that are listening from everywhere, is sometime around 2016 to 2019 when Zimbabwe went through another turmoil in its currency where we had the RTGS dollar. And effectively, these were said to be US dollars, ostensibly, but they were not US dollars, and you couldn't send your money outside. And there were many foreigners that were stuck within the country trying to take their money out, and they couldn't because what was actually in the system was now RTGS dollars and not US dollars. So a lot of foreigners creditors or suppliers that supply goods in Zimbabwe or loans in Zimbabwe couldn't take their money out. So the central bank then came up, or the treasury actually came up with SI 33 of 2019, I believe it was, where they came up with a way in which they ring-fenced all these funds. And they promised to then settle those funds and they moved them away from central bank because they were sitting on central bank's balance sheet. Because everybody would then send their payment instruction to RBZ, and then RBZ couldn't forward the transactions overseas. So it then became a loan, a debt that was sitting on central bank's balance sheet. And then what then happened with that SI was the movement from central bank to the country's fiscus. So it became a national debt. And then that national debt was to the tune of $2.9 billion. And what the central bank then did, what Treasury then did was to issue out Treasury bills. And these Treasury bills were the promise that they'll be able to settle these balances and transfer those monies offshore between, 20, I think the maturity was between 2024 and right through. The South African Airways has gone onto the market and it has actually intimated that they are owed about 50 million US, which is about R1 billion by the central bank, by Zimbabwean government. And this has not been, the feeling or the thought was they were going to be given $1 million a year, but this has not happened. Now they've elected not to discount their TBs and they've just kept what is owed to them. But now they've relayed to the market that this is a big concern. And surely we know where South African Airways is. They could do with the 50 million US dollars. So there's nothing unique about blocked funds. Right across Africa, this is something that we experience in Ethiopia in particular, and Ghana, Nigeria. But elsewhere, you then have, balance of payment support. So the IMF sort of comes in and then clears these blocked funds. In Zimbabwe, well, you will hold for a very long time. So that's the backstory. And I think that is something that we need to discuss because it has a lot of implications for Nostro, for FDI, and how we progress as a country, and especially with our currency issues. So maybe to kick us off, given that background, maybe we can start with you, Ranga. What are your thoughts and what do you think about this?
My issue when it comes to the blocked funds is, we are calling it Lagos debt. It sounds like maybe there's someone who borrowed from another, but these are monies that were due to these entities that were supposed to be paid. And these funds were there in the banking account, in the banking accounts of these particular entities, but they were just not being remitted because of the monetary system that was not allowing for those payments, because they were Zim dollars or the US dollars, and then we're not able to move those funds to the recipients. And that's I'm not sure if this is an experience that is shared even with those other countries that you say, you know, also experience the whole issue of blocked funds. But what it says for us is, I mean, we are a country that is trying to attract investment into the country. Businesses are they come, they operate here, but they struggle to move out their funds to a point where they have to be issued with a paper, which upon maturity, you're not going to be, then it's not going to be settled. I think that's not a good advertisement of, you know, an attractive market to investors. And I think it explains why we have seen such a massive outflow of capital from the country, because someone looks at it and say, even if I were to make the return that I'm projecting on this particular investment, am I able to move the funds out? And also the other issue is, it doesn't look like we are resolving these issues. We might continue to have this problem of blocked funds, maybe another 2.0, 3.0, because of the way we're dealing with the currencies. And I don't know why, like an airline, like right now, airline that are still operating, if someone wants to fly out of the country, they should pay in hard currency. I don't think people would have any problem with that. But giving an allowance for people to pay, say, in ZIG, when you know that the convertibility of ZIG into US dollars for onward payments to the service providers is not possible, I think it is not really helpful. So it's a recurring theme, and it's just not good for when you look at the narrative of where Zim is an investment destination.
Chumba?
Yeah, look, I think Maranga's captured it quite well. And, you know, I would contextualize it in the following manner. If you actually think about governments across the world, profligacy is, you know, for the most part, their default setting. You know, governments everywhere tend to spend more than they actually collect in revenue, and they over time accumulate debt. And I think, you know, so the challenge really is just how you manage that in the market. So if you think about this particular instance where we owe SAA $50 million, I'm sure over the last several years, we were in a position to pay them something.
Yeah, we promised to actually pay them $1 million a year.
Even if we didn't make that $1 million a year, if we paid $500,000 a year, if there was some progress, right, mm-hmm. I think that you will find that creditors are accommodating and are much more likely to take you seriously and come to the party in terms of helping you restructure your debt and raise new debt. And, you know, to the extent where the creditor is owed money, it's long overdue. Sometimes you're given a treasury bill with no coupon, no interest. So basically, and you know, I think people don't realize this, but over a long enough period of time, the purchasing power of US dollars actually falls off quite dramatically. So over like a 20-year period, the dollar loses about 80% of its purchasing power, which is massive, right? So if you are owed money over a significantly long period of time, and you're not being compensated for the effects of inflation, you're not getting an interest coupon, then you're really getting paid a small fraction of what is due to you. And so the point I want to make is that kind of behavior leaves a bitter taste in the mouths of creditors, and it just makes it so much harder for us to then restructure our debt and raise new capital.
So SAA is not a bank, you know. So these are like sort of business creditors. They are not lenders. So you'd say for a lender, okay, before you gave this particular individual some money, you should have done your KYC due diligence and make sure that, you know, and because bankers, they get some funds up front, they're charging you this for the risk that they are taking. This is a business. They're just operating. It's an airline operating a business normally. And they thought they'd collect, this was revenue to them, right? And
they were abiding by the laws of the country.
Exactly. It's revenue for them, part of their working capital, etc. And the problem for them was not to the person that received the service, you know. The person that received the service actually paid for it in some currency. It was our financial system that failed. It says a lot about us as investment destination, that you could have all, you could be ticking all the boxes in terms of, okay, this is an attractive investment, good ROI, good this and that, but this is typical country risk where something that you can't control just comes and like all the revenue that it booked, you can't get it because the bank system can't move
it. You have to raise it up.
And, okay. And there's something particularly egregious about this instance, because every day that SAA has flights into or out of the country, they're actually an agent of the state, in that whenever you buy a ticket on SAA, right, part of that ticket is actually taxes that the airline is collecting and then remits to the state. So every day they're actually operating, they are collecting money on behalf of the state, and yet the state can't, you know, come to the party with its obligations.
Yeah, it's a big issue. So I want to get, gentlemen, I want us to discuss two things with this factor, because it does affect our monetary system in a drastic way, I'm afraid. And we have to discuss it, because I think it's something that people have already forgotten. Is this, that part of these $3 billion has been discounted by the banks, and banks are holding on to these TBs. Part of it is still that our creditors, international creditors, are holding. They were not happy at discounting. They were then happy with the terms that government of Zimbabwe had come up with, which is they would pay out from 2024 right through to 2040. And I think that we've got payments from now right through to 2026, close to about $1 billion or $1.5 billion that must be paid out. Now, we know that our government is under strain and doesn't have that kind of money to pay out. What are the implications of this? First, for our creditors who are outside, who thought, oh, okay, I haven't been paid since 2026, since 2016, but, you know, government has promised to pay me in 2024. I can wait. Let's see what happens. And then banks that are holding on to these TBs and hoping that they will get paid in 2024, and that's not going to happen, probably be rolled over. What are the implications?
For the creditors, I think the more prudent ones actually discounted these papers as soon as they got them. So you'd expect that the majority would have done that. I don't know why some decided to hold on to the paper.
Because the discount rates were ridiculous, upwards of 50%.
No, they're not 60%. Ridiculous. They were reflective of the risk. You see? So,
Ranga, if you're SAA and then you write off 60, 70% of your 50 billion, that sinks your business.
Yeah,
but SAA is a bad example. It's not exactly the best led business over the last 20
no,
years.
No, we're saying everybody. Yeah. I think Ranga put it very succinctly. These are not people who lent money to Zimbabwe. These were people who provided a service, and the cash was in their accounts, and now they wanted to get their money out and they couldn't. So they were not taking the kind of risk that they eventually took. And then they got punished by the financial markets. We were discussing in this paper upwards of 70% some. And now, I mean, it's fair enough. Somebody would have decided that, you know what?
Let me hold on.
Let me hold on. Let me wait. Because they still trusted the government.
But why would you why would you trust a counterparty that has failed you so egregiously?
Well, that's why we're here to discuss this, because it has an implication, right?
Yeah.
It has an implication now going forward that you waited until 2024. Now what's going to happen? Now, you're saying trust. Okay, so the bank that discounted it, kudos to them. They booked the profits. Now, do they think they will get paid in 2024?
I think for the banks, it's their business. It's part of their business. And so if you look at the bank, the model, so they might take a hit on this side, but overall, because, I mean, they're just holding these assets. I think the banks will not come out poorer compared to maybe your SAA. Because for the banks, if they get them at a very steep discount, they should have been able to book in some profits, at least up to that point. And on the balance sheet of banks, you don't discount TBs, as it were. So your balance sheet will still look good. And to the extent that... this guy is...
So they discounted, they took the profits, and the nominal value is
yes.
Because on the team on their balance sheet.
Exactly.
This is where I'm going with this.
International Financial Reporting Standard number 9.
Please tell us that you just wanted to make us laugh.
No. I'm just spitting out facts.
Yeah.
That when it comes to accounting for banking revenue, so a treasury bill, you take it as 100%. So you record it at 100%. The IFRS actually say you can, all the other assets that you have on your balance sheet, including loans or even say properties, you have to discount them steeply. But when you're holding a treasury bill, it's one-to-one. So in terms of the capital positions of the banks and the balance sheet of the banks, it looks good. And banks are creative. But some of them, they will then use the TBs on their balance sheet to access more funding, say, from the central bank, and be able to create more business. So I don't think there's any bank that will come out saying, we have lost money from holding TBs. I mean, I think
the monetary system, and Rory, you can come in, yeah? Mm-hmm. Because that's why we were laughing, that... So let's take...
These guys have got no trust in treasury bills.
No, what we're saying is... We're
the return is risk-free.
No, no, we're agreeing with you, but we're saying that's the bigger problem, because now on the balance sheet, you've got total assets, you've got this maybe not 3 billion that's actually sitting with the banks, but let's call it $1 billion that's sitting with the banks. Mm-hmm. They booked their profit 3 years ago, and they took their profits out. They're hoping that this $1 billion will get paid in 2024, 2025. Mm-hmm. It's not paid out. Now you have this very curious case we have with Nostro, where total assets, total deposits in the banking sector, it's now about $2.7 billion. But actual cash is only about $800 million and fast dwindling. A year ago, it was $1.2 billion. It's now $800 million. Now, with this added factor, where they were hoping that there would be a bit of liquidity within the Nostro because government was going to pay out. And if government doesn't pay out and it rolls out, what is happening with our Nostro? That's the question I pose to you.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, basically, at some point, what it means is that payments are going to fail, right? Because, firstly, our government is not in a position to print US dollars, right? It's a foreign currency. And a lot of these treasury bills are actually denominated in US dollars. So I can't understand why anybody would go with the idea that they're risk-free because the counterparty on the other side is government of Zimbabwe.
All bankers actually believe that they're risk-free. I remember I had heated debate with a very senior banker about this, I think in 2016. Mm-hmm. I confronted them and I said, you know what? Your balance sheet right now, you have to impair it because these TBs, you're not going to get dollar for dollar. Because I'm not like, no. It's government. Government is not going to default and etc. And look, I don't know whether it's trust or naivety on the part of the bankers, but I think the reason why banks really don't make a fuss when it regards to the TBs is they don't lose from the transaction as it were. They still make their money. They still find ways. So the guys that we need to talk about are your creditors.
It's depositors.
Yes.
It's depositors' funds. Exactly. They're using depositors' funds. And
your SAA and other guys, or the creditors, those are the guys who are really in
To me, it affects the monetary system.
It does.
That's my big worry.
It does.
Is that we're actually exaggerating the RTGS dollars. We're getting into 2.0 of what we got into in 2016, where we're exaggerating what we are terming RTGS dollars, which are not actually backed by real dollars.
You mean the nostros?
Yeah,
nostros. Well, now they're called FCAs.
Well, no, they don't. They don't.
Legally, I'm saying what used to be Nostro before Zig is now called FCA.
FCA. Yeah. Okay.
It's arose by another name, but you know. Yeah.
Fair enough. Got it.
Yeah, but all that this is doing is just—it's simply, you know, it's actually, and the central bank themselves speak to this that you know, we understand this past trauma, but we want to build new building blocks for a brighter future. But actually, in reality, what's happening on the ground is that the trauma seems to be ongoing. Mm. And all that this does is it hurts the formal sector. It further hurts faith and confidence in the banking sector. And it just pushes further away the date that things will actually be normal again in this part of the world.
Mm.
Don't you think that government is actually caught up in a situation where they don't have a solution? They're at their wit's end in terms of getting out of this pickle.
I think the problem is they never address it that way. They don't think that they're in a problem. That's why we have shows like ourselves, is to remind them that actually there's a big problem. And especially with this one, because like I said, it's nothing unusual. Kenya, Ghana, Ethiopia, they have these sort of problems. But what they then have, and this is why you have an organization like the IMF, is it will come in and bridge that balance of payment problem that you have. If you think about it, $3 billion, and then with the maturities, they will say, you know what, it's necessary to inject that liquidity within the banking sector, because your banking sector becomes extremely fragile because you have these TBs one-to-one that are sitting on your balance sheet when you all know that they're not worth the paper they're written on. And then you have other suppliers and international creditors who require that liquidity to continue functioning in your particular markets. So the IMF then comes in and says, okay, fair enough, we will close that gap for you. And then government can then deal directly with the IMF going forward. But we don't have balance of payment support. And this is the issue that then we have with the Adesina and Chissano negotiations, that, you know, debt relief is something that we have to seriously look at, and we have to think about it carefully, because we're exacerbating the situation, and it's going to be drastic going into next year and going into 2026. This is going to be an Achilles heel, and it's going to ensure that our nostro balances are not exactly nostro balances, and it's going to be problematic. Guys, because we have to move, I think that we've addressed that. Let's talk about agriculture. So we had a drought, El Nino-induced drought, which led to us importing about 1 million metric tons. Most of that was actually imported by the private sector, but what it just meant is we diverted our foreign currency instead of, you know, our farmers producing, they couldn't produce enough. So we ended up using the scarce foreign currency that we have to actually import. But going into next year, there were there was the anticipation that it was going to be a better season. We were expecting the La Nina effect, which is the opposite of the El Nino effect. But we are told that the reports that we're getting, it's fading away. The La Nina effect is fading away, which means that between now and December, we'll get no more to below normal rainfall. And then going into from January to March, then we're expecting normal to above normal. What does this mean? You're the farmer.
It means farmers who, I think a bigger proportion of them that...
We don't swear on this show.
A bigger proportion of them who fund their own farming activities will find it very difficult to go back into the field, you know. It's always difficult every time after a drought, a certain number actually is dropped. Or either they reduce the hectareage or they totally fail to go back into farming because, you know, working capital is decimated and you are not too sure whether the season that you are looking at is going to be any better. Now, if you add that dimension that the above normal to above normal rainfall that was anticipated is unlikely to occur, then obviously more and more farmers that depend on rain for their cropping are going to just not commit their little capital into that space. Again, that's pressure. So you are talking about the pressure of importing 1 million metric tons, or maybe if you say $300 per ton, that's like $300 million US dollars that we have to pay. And now we have to add the cost of inputs. So for even the household to be able to really plant something with whether it's Fumfuza or some other model, we need to spend again on farming inputs. It probably would take another 100 or 200 million. And I think it explains why we keep seeing even our nostrils, the value actually depreciating, because we are dipping into that. It's not like we are creating, we are generating
new forex.
So it's not looking good. And we have to accept climate change is here. And this is not a once-off thing. We should expect a recurrence of these droughts. Mm. So I think if you are planning with, say, 5-10 years in mind, we need to start saying, okay, what do we need to do? Investing in irrigation and ensure that a small proportion of our farmers still depend on rains, and the majority are operating as...
And when you say we, who is that person who's going to do this?
We, the government, people of Zimbabwe.
La Nina is likely to be weak and short-lived, which then puts a bigger strain again on government finances as far as taking care of the vulnerable. Mm. But in the economy, you know, can Zim afford another drought? Can Zim afford another grain deficit?
No, of course not. We can't afford another drought or grain deficit. I think the government's capacity to help the society's least and most vulnerable is impaired, because we're already coming out of a drought. We already have headwinds where government revenue from the formal sector is shrinking for various reasons, you know, not least of which the lower commodity prices. So government is not actually in the best position to help out when it comes to the, you know, food security. But what I wanted to actually, the point I really want to make when it comes to this issue, you know, droughts and agriculture, is that since land reform, you know, almost 20 years ago, every year we've been importing more than 1 million tons of grain, with the exception of, I think, 2 years ago when we had a fantastic rainy season. So I think that the land reform project has fallen far short of its aspirations, and we need to have a conversation about what we can do differently.
But grain was never coming from the commercial farmers. Grain was always coming from the small-scale farmers.
No, no. Before before land reform, we were actually net exporters of grain.
And I'm saying that the grain was actually coming from the rural farmers, small-scale farmers. It wasn't coming from commercial farmers. Commercial farmers had long moved away from...
No. The biggest producers of maize were commercial farmers. And they had the best yields, and that's why we were always in surplus. And which is why, because if what you're saying is correct, if it was the subsistence farmers, land reform wouldn't have actually affected our...
No, land reform, if you think about it, commercial farmers were always, and that's why they were termed commercial farmers, because they moved away from grain, because grain was not profitable. Especially when GMB was doing, you know, I mean, right now the prices are subsidized. So, you know, you're paying $300 per ton, which is ridiculously way above what you find on the open market. A lot of the commercial farmers were now in tobacco and other commercial crops and not grain, primarily.
Why is grain production affected by land reform in your mind?
Well, a number of issues. We destroyed the ecosystem, the agriculture ecosystem, because it all works within an ecosystem. A lot of the grain that the commercial farmers produced was actually for their food, for
livestock.
So a lot of it was for livestock. Now, there's no one who's producing that grain for the livestock. So it means it's all now incumbent upon the small-scale farmers. The other reality that we have to look at, especially with commercial farming, especially with the land reform, is it displaced a lot of people, and it displaced a lot of farmers, even within the rural confines. So people who were usually farming within the rural confines moved from the rural areas to these commercial areas. And then these commercial areas, they were not producing. And they were now producing far less than they used to produce in their rural areas. But anyway, we've got a farmer here. If I'm speaking out of term, please come in. Your thoughts?
He's not really a farmer.
Wow. But
I think he's a much better analyst than he's a farmer.
The displacement. But and please in the comment in the comment section, if I'm wrong, please call me out on this. But I think the displacement of farmers who moved away from, you know, rural grain production and then moved into these commercial entities, either stopped producing or they went commercial. They went tobacco.
So
they started producing tobacco and less grain, because it actually doesn't make sense to be producing grain. But go ahead.
No. You have actually made the point. I was going to say that a number of them that benefited from the land reform also chose to grow commercial crops, with tobacco being the major beneficiary there. And I think also what made us not feel like the impact of that was, like you're saying, it was an ecosystem. So most of these small farmers who were doing crops, they were probably situated around a big commercial entity. So it means they would have, for their commercial needs or for their cash needs, maybe they were supplying this commercial entity something. For example, say...
That's true.
You are in a sugarcane growing region. So maybe a bigger part of what you're doing, you are a small-scale producer of sugarcane, but you still have a small portion that you're leaving for grains. So it means you have got your cash covered by the crop that you're producing, and then you have got enough space to do your grains. But right now, when you don't have that ecosystem now, and you have to survive purely on the farming, I think most of them tended to choose growing cash crops. And you're seeing, even in terms of government policy, policies like the input schemes or the Pfumvuzas, I think just they're actually trying to incentivize resettled farmers to produce grain. And you'd find most of them had actually stopped producing grain. If you go in some places, say Mashonaland Central, around Mashonaland actually, most of those farmers, they are busy on their tobacco crop, and they totally are forgotten about grain because of the GMB issues and et cetera.
Okay. I'm happy to concede that point because it doesn't change, the argument that I was hoping to make, which is that production on farms is not optimum by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think anybody's going to argue that. Exploiting the arable land to its full potential or anywhere near its full potential. And I think part of the problem with that is because of the tenure structure. Because you have a cohort that has an offer letter, which can be withdrawn arbitrarily. So even if you have capacity to deploy meaningful amounts of capital onto your farm, you don't have security of tenure. You can wake up tomorrow and you're out of favor, the offer letter is arbitrarily withdrawn, and somebody else benefits from your investment. And this is assuming that you actually have capacity to raise capital. An A2 letter is not, an offer letter is not acceptable collateral in our banking system today. So anybody on land on that basis does not have capacity to get debt funding from the banking system.
Mm.
So I think that this crisis is an opportunity for us to rethink the framework and the structure of agriculture and
something. Actual 2024, they got a gross target of about $37 billion, which is about 2.6.
37 billion or 3.7 billion?
No, 37 billion.
US dollars? Oh, no, you mean zig. Okay? Yeah, it can't be US dollars.
sorry. actual zig, 37 billion zig, which is about 2.6 billion, using the going rate. But we know we started with Zim dollars. It's likely, in real terms, it's likely to be around 1.5 to about 1.8 billion mm-hmm. US dollars. So if you think about it, that's way lower than what we used to collect 10 years ago.
And in recent time, you also see the impact of the current confusion. Because remember last year and the year before, when Azimra was reporting that they'd collected way more than what they budgeted for, it was because each successive year there was an increase in the proportion of US dollar revenue that they were collecting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Even in the last 6 months, they will tell us that they've collected 6% more than they collected last year.
Yeah.
But if we look at it from an inflation perspective, last year and this year, it means that they're way behind inflation.
Yeah, so some of the policies...
And 50% of their collections are actually in local currency. So a lot of it will be... That's why I said a rough number to use is to think that for the first 6 months, we collected about 1.8. If you're being generous to them in real terms. But it looks like we will collect less than $4 billion, which is what we used to collect 10 years ago. We used to collect about $4 billion 10 years ago.
And the purchasing power of that amount of money
is equivalent to $5.5 billion today. That's true. But more importantly, we had less taxes. So you've got more taxes now, but you're collecting less. This is a big worry because our expenditure, when you look at our expenditure, it has actually increased. But before we get into the weeds of Zimra, let's talk about Trump and the tax that he wants to introduce. Let's have a discussion. He thinks that we should scrap income tax and government should rely on tariffs. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, I think philosophically it's an interesting conversation to have because there's this debate about what's the best way to raise tax revenue. Is it to tax income or is it to tax consumption? And there's a case to be made that consumption makes much more sense because you want to encourage individuals and corporates to generate as much income as possible. And if income is not being taxed, then you know that's a that incentivizes even more income generation. And then how people choose to spend their money is then up to them, and they get taxed at the point of consumption. So if you think about it in this context of tariffs versus income tax, a tariff really is a consumptive tax because you're charging tariffs on imports, which people consume. Mm-hmm. But it becomes complicated in the US case because a lot of what they import is actually used in production, and it also has an impact on inflation. I don't have strong views one way or the other. Although my intuition is that you're better off taxing consumption than income.
Okay. A philosophical argument. Should we tax income or should we tax consumption?
My issue with consumption is it doesn't, it tends to penalize the low,
the poor.
The poor, you know. it tends to penalize the poor and doesn't take, it doesn't have, you know, it fails when you consider it from the equity point of view.
The tax burden is more.
Yeah,
it's more on the poor.
Because they are spending probably 70-80% mm-hmm. of their income in
groceries.
On groceries, and yet you are taxing them, and then there are these billionaires that are spending just a tiny little amount on consumption.
But they do buy yachts.
Yeah, but I think
and jets,
but as
and
a
big ticket items.
Yeah, as a proportion of their income, I think that will still be very, very small relative to when you say we want to tax income, because obviously they'll be generating income at a much bigger scale.
Allow me to push back a little bit.
Wait. Let him argue the case, and then we can then have a discussion. Go ahead.
So if you are taxing income, then you allow for progressive taxation, where someone who's earning more, they have to be taxed more. Biblically, to whom more is given, more is expected.
But then a tithe is not progressive. Mm. A tithe is actually just 10%.
And what did the Messiah say when that old lady paid her last denarii? He said, actually, this person has paid more. So it's not talking about equity. That this denarii might not be valuable in the bigger scheme of things, but this represents probably 100% of what she owns.
Ranga, the church says 10%.
Okay. We're not going into this into this theological rabbit hole.
No, that's the plane in which he wants to play. So let him answer first. The law of tithe says 10%. Whether you earn a dollar or whether you earn $1 billion, the law of tithing is 10%.
Yeah, so
similarly with consumption, that if you're
but
if you're
that's not the only giving that you are doing in that, if you take it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So tithing would be like it's more the regulatory kind of, but the principle actually, a religious biblical principle, is the one who has more has to pay more.
Well, effectively, you are paying more, right?
10%, no, you're not.
10% of a billion.
It's proportionately.
No,
so if you're paying,
then you're punishing.
If you're
penalizing,
you're penalizing success
for success. Yeah. Then I think I've given you enough rope to hang yourself. Do you want to reply to this?
So he
makes the argument, and maybe for contextual purposes, before you come in, for the longest, America had tariffs. They didn't have income tax. They introduced income tax.
1913
on the 3rd of October.
Yeah, I need to say something about the tariffs before he gets in.
Okay.
That the reason why I don't support tariffs is because, if impose a tariff on goods coming from China, China also retaliate. So it's not good for international trade when you are using tariffs.
Do you think you can export into China without tariffs, by the way? What do you think the current...
Okay, gentlemen, I think on the next issue, we'll then discuss trade.
Okay.
But here we want to focus purely on revenue generating, which one is the best? Should we use tariffs?
I'm saying income.
You're saying income,
yeah,
right? And the basis in which you're saying so, it's equity. Because the burden is now more on
the poor,
on the rich. If it's income, the burden then becomes and the context I wanted us to understand,
which I think is a fallacy, but anyway,
yeah, that's what I want you to debunk, or you know, to see if the audience can actually be convinced. But the context was America for the longest relied on tariffs and not on income tax. Income tax was only introduced in 1913 on the 3rd of October, as well as the central bank, the Reserve Bank, the Fed, was also introduced in 2013. So there were a raft of laws that were introduced by the Democrats, primarily because the burden, they felt that the burden was really on the poor, when the burden of society should really lie disproportionately with the rich. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think it's a fallacy. So, you know, I mean, we can go into a rabbit hole about whether or not progressive taxation is theft. That's a separate, discussion. You know, I would say it's theft, but, let's put that aside for a minute and just look at the data, the reality on the ground in terms of taxation in most parts of the world, income tax. The reality is that most income tax is actually paid by the rich. So whether it's in the US, in Europe,
in most parts of the world. Ranga and the progressive left is saying that's actually what we want. We want the burden
on
the rich.
So that's already the status quo when it comes to income. And it will also be the status quo when it comes, if you move from income to tariffs, the same will be true. Because, the rich spend significantly more than the poor. And therefore, their proportion, their contribution in tariffs will be significantly higher than the poor. Right? So most government revenue will always come from the rich. Mm. Right?
Okay.
So this idea that somehow the poor will pay more in one dispensation or the other, I think is a fallacy.
Mm. Okay, so let me contextualize. I think that there are arguments to be had on both sides of the aisle. Very valid arguments to be had. But unfortunately, the reality on the ground is that it's easier to tax income than it is to tax consumption, especially over a longer period of time. Because consumption, the problem with taxing consumption is that people change. They substitute whatever it is. And when it's a tariff, maybe, and especially the Trump tariff, maybe that's actually what you want. You want people to import less and for people to actually produce within in country. So then you have that substitution effect. But the reality is it's easier and more sustainable to tax income.
I don't think that's true. I think the opposite is true.
No, because people change consumptive patterns. Whereas your income... So let me give you a very good example. You wake up tomorrow and... What do you call your alcohol? Whatever it is.
Yeah, La Frog.
La Frog. Okay. So you wake up tomorrow.
Butchered that.
You wake up tomorrow and they've put a tax on it, 100% tax on it. Mm-hmm. Now, and you might switch. So you might still have it for another two or three bottles, but eventually.
I might decide the tax is too high.
And you might just decide to drink something else.
Yeah.
But for you. For your entire life, what's likely to happen with your income is it's more likely to increase than it is to decrease. And you're more likely, it's not like you will switch and then not work. You will continuously be working for the entirety of your life. Mm. But you might, touch wood, you might actually give up on alcohol altogether.
This is not wood, thankfully. Anyway, so look, I hear you.
So
let me correct you. When you think about income tax, in most parts of the world, right? So the wealthiest people, a significant portion of their, in fact, the vast majority of their fortune is actually capital, right? They own property, they own equity in businesses. And their salaries, to the extent that they have them, are actually a tiny portion of their net worth and
profit,
capacity.
Profit is still income.
His profit is still income. So the corporate pays the profit, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's still, we consider that as income.
And corporates are incredibly skilled. The bigger they are, the more sophisticated they are, the more lawyers and accountants they can employ. They're very good at avoiding taxes.
As a tax head, mm-hmm. profit tax will contribute close to 15 to 20%. As a tax. So it is still a big component.
Yeah, yeah, no, no, no.
So
no.
We still consider it as
income. So, okay. But let me just, let me make my point. Let me finish my point.
Simplicity.
So I'm talking about simplicity, right? Mm. So if you think about, and I will use Zimbabwe's example with IMTT, right?
First of all, we want it to be ideological.
Yeah, yeah, but I want to give you an example to make my ideological point, right?
Okay.
So in a place like Zimbabwe, where, you know, the biggest bank is the National Mattress Bank and the informal sector is bigger than the formal sector, IMTT is not going to be, it's not going to touch every aspect of our economy or most aspects of our economy. But in highly formal economies like Europe and the rest of the developed world, like the US, right, if they had a tax like that, right, that taxes every transaction, because 90% plus of the transactions in that part of the world go through the formal banking sector, it's so much easier to actually collect that tax, right? Because for income tax, everybody has to do a return, and people who are diligent and conscientious can figure out how to pay less, right?
IMTT is a tax on production. Yeah, we want to stick to consumption.
Yeah, so a consumption tax is like a sales tax. Okay, so yeah, IMTT was a bad example. So my bad.
Yeah, that's
but a sales tax, right? So you say blanket sales tax VAT. on most items, right? VAT is actually quite complex because you've got input VAT and output.
Whereas sales tax,
sales tax is much simpler. You just say, hey, if you're selling anything, X percent goes to the state. There's no return. There's nothing, you know, right? That's easy to collect. Presumptive taxes. You know, for every, if you are,
we get your point. You are right. It's easier to tax, but not enough.
That's a completely different argument.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the real argument. The real argument. And that's why I think that Trump has put, you know, the cat amongst the pigeons. And it's a very good debate because the real argument, the pushback that Trump is going to receive and that we would receive if we were to argue is that governments have become substantially bigger over the period. So while we can have this debate, and in 1900 you could have had this debate, and there were very good points on either side of the aisle. The reality is because of income tax, because of government over the years, over 100 years, is that government has increased by, you know, a thousandfold.
Yeah, right? And also just, since you say philosophically, we measure, okay, fine, economic output is measured so many ways, consumption, income, or whatever. But I would say the main activity that we see before you start consuming or spending, you have to generate some income. Mm-hmm. And it's not every dollar of income that we generate that is consumed. So if you really want to capture more of economic activity, you tend to do that with income. Because, I mean, everyone is out there on a typical day. They are being productive. They can always... So there are some who will be like Shumba here who thinks that for him to get his high, he needs to spend $100. But someone for the same income that you're generating, they're probably going to buy...
And decide to save.
Yes.
So you're actually supporting Trump.
So I'm on the income, not on the consumption. Because
if you're taxing income, then the guy doesn't have enough. You're actually incentivizing consumption.
That's okay.
Whereas if you tax consumption, you're incentivizing saving.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, because then somebody thinks.
Oh, yeah, but what are you going to do? Well, what are you going to do with your savings?
You know, economic growth. Economic growth is actually engendered by savings. You need the growth comes from savings. The economic growth actually comes from savings. That's why I said what Trump has done. It's something that would make us think a lot, because the system that we have, and especially in America, if you look at consumption, What has happened over the last 100 years is that actually it's a consumptive society and less savings society. And if you wanted
the most productive society on the planet.
Exactly. So what could they achieve if they started saving more? You know, then you start getting in America growing at rates of 5-7%.
I actually I'm amazed that you've taken that line of thinking. I thought that where we were going with this was at the point you made, which is that if you move from income to tariffs, the state will collect less revenue and therefore will have to have a leaner, smaller
government. Yeah, oh no, that's a
which
given.
Is fantastic.
No, that's a given. That's why I said it's a cat amongst the pigeons, because Trump, if you look at what Elon Musk is propagating, which is a more efficient bureaucracy, is if you can fix that, then you don't need to tax income.
Because you can run on a much smaller budget.
If you can run on a much smaller budget, then it means that it's a smaller government, but it also then means that people have enough income. They can do whatever they want with their income. And they're less likely to consume, because America is a rich society. They're more likely to save. And if they save, then that's the money that you use to reduce the national debt, because, you know, America's national debt is a huge problem.
If the country is spending less, then deficits go away. They actually move from deficits to surpluses, and the surplus can pay down the debt.
But you don't have
a debt issue.
But you still need the spending, because they are generating income, right?
Mm-hmm.
For them to be generating income, someone has
Who's them? The government or individuals or corporates?
So it's the government.
Yeah.
Or the economy is generating income.
Mm-hmm.
It's generating income because there's production, there's consumption. So someone has to consume whatever you're producing from which you're getting your income. So you need to have some balance. It's not possible for you to just
push. So say in economic theory,
and you
had actually captured it correctly, that we should focus more on the income than on the consumption, because people will always consume. Once you produce the goods, then people will consume. But what you want is, and that's why you have globalization, right, is people can consume the product that are way outside of your borders and not necessarily you. But
then now the issue of tariffs that you're saying.
Yes, I think that the tariff issue is one that I want us to deal with maybe next time. Because
we can do a rabbit hole.
Yeah, we can do a, because it's an interesting thing, because they're both sides of the arguments. There's a very strong, especially if you ask for, you know, no tariffs, right? And you say, you know what, it actually doesn't matter. When you put tariffs, the person that you're actually hurting is the consumer.
The consumer, yeah.
But that's, let's have these debates later on, because I think it's a balance of what do we want to achieve. And I think that if you have no income tax as a target, I think that the machinery will never allow it, not in our lifetime.
Which machinery are you talking about?
I'm talking about the government, the bureaucrats, because the bureaucrats are the ones that benefit from this.
But don't the bureaucrats work for us?
You wish. But coming back, to Zimra, because that was a good segue. Because they face more or less the same problem. Now, they've moved. So they used to tax income, and a lot of their taxes were actually coming from income.
Mm-hmm.
But then that started dwindling, and the formal sector is actually dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
Then they moved to consumptive tax,
mm-hmm.
and then that also started dwindling. Then they moved to production tax. IMTT is a production tax. So anyone who's transferring money, it's more likely that they're in some sort of production, right? It's less consumptive. It's because you are actually producing. And then they started taxing that. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen. It hasn't helped. What can Zimra do? Where can Zimra get the income? What do they need to do?
I don't think it's a Zimra problem.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, it's not a Zimra problem.
Okay.
I think that, you know, that transition that you are talking about from taxing income, consumption, and production just tells you that all these years, all these times, Zimra has been trying to track, you know, basically chasing shadows, as it were, So they feel like, ah, no, this is where you can get it. This is where you can get it. But the reality is the semi-economy is actually shrinking. But also there's a lot of informalization that is taking place. I think right now, whether it's a corporate or even individual, one of the biggest, you know, hassles that you have to do is, you know, find ways of avoiding paying taxes. In, you know, so one, you don't have that moral obligation as it were, because for some, they're like, ah, my, I'm paying taxes, but, you know, the funds are being misused. I've heard that several times. But it's not really a moral argument, but it's an economic one where everything has informalized. So even the IMTT, the reason why maybe it made sense when they introduced it, they're saying, ah, people, this is where we can capture all those ones who are not
everyone who's much in the formal sector.
We're in the informal sector.
Because they bank formally.
Exactly.
But that's not true anymore.
But we're not banking anymore. There's nothing to bank. We're just talking.
People moved.
People have moved away from the bank, whether it's Zig or it's Nostro. Now, how do you deal with transaction taking place in the formal market, and they're happening in cash.
So in other words, Zimra should be a champion for formalization of business.
Certainly.
Well, Zimra is not going to collect meaningful amounts of money in a shrinking formal sector, right? So Ranga framed it very well. The problem is not at Zimra. The problem is the macroeconomic policy framework, which brings us to, you know, the budget that's coming up, right? Like, how do you create incentives for people to move from the informal sector into the formal sector and not the opposite, which is what's been happening over the last several years?
The other thing that Zimra is facing is inflation. So according to Steve Hanke, the inflation rate is 1,300%, Zimra revenue has actually grown by 5% over the last...
I don't know how Steve Hanke has become an authority on Zim inflation, because if you think about it, the local currency is less than 20% of the economy. So why does anybody actually care what the inflation rate there is? Because the higher it is...
So even if it's 20%, we still want to know what the inflation rate is.
Yeah, but the higher...
If you don't want to know, that's perfectly fine. If in your world, you never use the local currency, that's perfectly fine. But if you're a civil servant, if you're a bank employee... This might choke you, but
it's not going more to than me.
Because if you include civil servants, there are more people who are paid in local currency than they are who are paid purely in US dollars.
No, for sure.
So then inflation becomes a real thing for them.
Yeah, but their local currency salaries and wages are adjusted routinely to
kind
of track it.
To what?
To attempt to track it.
To track what?
Inflation. But having said that, I don't.
That's why Steve Hanke is saying, okay.
But how is he an authority,
if
though?
Like, if you're, like, how is he coming okay, up so with the I don't want to discuss whether he's an authority or not. If you have someone else who's proffering these inflation numbers, please help us. But I'm saying Steve Hanke says inflation rate has increased by 1,300% over the last year. And if you're an employee and you're earning in local currency, have your earnings gone up by 1,300%?
An employee in this environment, I think, would look less on inflation, but more on the exchange rate, given the dollarization.
It's Steve Hanke is more or less a proxy of the exchange rate. The exchange rate, it means that the exchange rate has moved.
Yeah, it has moved. So I'm saying in terms of the parameter or the indicator that model employee that you're talking about, the indicator that they're watching the most is actually not inflation, because when they go to
I'm saying the proxy to the exchange rate is actually the
you're saying we're actually starting from US dollars. That's why I think I would agree with Rufaro that Zig has become so irrelevant that any discussion around monetary phenomenon around Zig are not really that useful.
Okay, so you're an employee. Mm-hmm. Last year, you were being paid in Zim dollars. Mm-hmm. This year, you're still being paid in Zim dollars. How do you know that you've kept up.
If such a person exists where 100% of their salary,
the majority,
100% of their salary.
No, whatever the portion.
Then they're not an employee; they're a labor donor.
Okay, so let's not make fun of the majority.
Nobody's people. Earning 100%.
Even if you're making 50%, if you're a civil servant and you're earning 50% of your salary, is actually coming in local currency. This is the reality of the majority of people in Zimbabwe. The reality of the majority of people in Zimbabwe is that they earn a portion.
A portion, yes. Yeah. They all agree with you, but not a majority.
The majority
most
of earn.
Most Zimbabwean income is not in local currency. To the extent that people are also paid in local currency, it's a small portion of their wage.
No, it's with civil servants, it's 50%. If you're in the financial services sector, it's 100% local currency.
But they get loans, Zig loans. So
okay,
at guys. The end of the day, that's remuneration. Cost to company.
Okay, guys, let's not get into remuneration. Let's get into the reality is you've got people who are earning
local currency.
I don't know why you guys are getting.
Let's deal with that. Actually, let's take what you're saying at face value. Mm. Okay, because regardless of how you're paid, right? If you live in a room in a high density suburb, chances are your rental is in US dollars.
Almost certainly not. Mm. Yeah.
So you have to convert.
I'm being charitable to Tinashe.
No.
You have to convert. So and a lot of your living expenses are actually denominated in hard currency. Mm-hmm. So I just want to buttress Ranga's point and actually just take it to its natural conclusion, which is whatever proportion an employer is paying in local currency in terms of their employees' remuneration, right? Every month they have to face the reality that individual has these bills that are fundamental to their subsistence that are in US dollars, mm-hmm. right? So the employer can say whatever they want about, I can't increase it by this much or that much or whatever. But the reality is the employee has a significant proportion
of
their bills in hard currency.
So in short, you're saying Steve Hang's number is actually not
It's useful. Academic. It's not it's useful. Not useful. Nobody's looking at that number and saying,
I almost said it's useless.
Okay, so I think that the issue is just purely because it's Steve Hank who's saying this. Because what Steve Hank is saying is if you earn...
I have no issues with Steve Hank, by the way.
No, it's a very simple mathematical thing. Mm. I don't know why... And you guys are supposed to be experts in this. It's simple and straightforward. He's just saying, if you were paid in Zim dollars, mm-hmm. Whatever the portion was, if you were paid in Zim dollars last year, for every dollar you got paid, if mm-hmm. you were to convert it into US dollars, if today it's not 1,300, then you're worse off. That's it.
Let me put it this way.
I think without saying that, on average, every Zimbabwean is worse off.
Oh my gosh.
We're mostly poorer.
Yeah, mostly poorer.
And he's quantifying it.
No, he's not quantifying it. He's coming up with an airy fairy academic number.
Yeah,
it's not an airy fairy academic number.
So if you use the US dollars, Rufaro.
Okay, so like I said, I think you guys have got your problem is with Steve Hank.
No, okay. I don't have a problem with Steve Hank.
No, you do because I think it's because you are triggered, and how much is he surprised? Okay, so simple and straightforward. If last year in October you were earning an equivalent of a dollar
mm-hmm.
in US, so you're earning in local currency, and the equivalent of it is a dollar, and that dollar you were paying rent. How much should you be earning today in local currency for you to still pay a dollar in rentals?
I have no idea.
I would just know that people still get
and I don't really care.
And because
the employee wants to pay their rent.
All right, yeah. Gentlemen, I think our time is done. Like I said, are you guys in the comment section? Please let us know. Are you also triggered by Steve Henk? The minute you hear the name Steve Henk, you're triggered. And you don't really look at what he's trying to say with these numbers. If you earn in local currency, please tell us, you know, what has actually been happening with you when you compare last year to this year. And please quantify for us and see if that number is more or less with what Steve Henk is actually saying. Otherwise, we had a number of things that we wanted to talk about, but as usual, we always have so many words and not enough time. But anyway, have yourself a wonderful Friday and an enjoyable weekend. See you next time. Cheers.
Cheers.
I've got energy for around.